Bueno, la difícil es que escucha la parte que está fallando. Y está
guay.
Bueno, pero yo no sé si yo para que escondo la paso una poco más también. No, no sé si te habrá un link privado, no pasa ninguna.
¿Y a Borda Estiva? ¿Quedas por aquí?
No, 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 estaría para Barcelona.
Okay. All right. Well, first of all, thank you very much to the organizers for the opportunity to speak here. I enjoyed the morning session quite a bit. well, it's beautiful science that David and Alex were talking about. So mine is going to be way, way less advanced. And it's going to be a little bit of an overview of things which are, I think, well known to those people to whom they're well known. So the title is Relativistic Hydrodynamics and Fluctuations. And what I'm going to be talking about is about really small fluctuations. So it's really the whole talk is about small fluctuation physics. So there is not going to be a lot of, strong out of equilibrium dynamics, turbulence, nothing like that. So the plan for the talk is, first I'm going to review relativistic hydrodynamics in normal fluids. Turns out that relativistic hydrodynamics is a little bit of a subtler subject than I initially thought when I started to think about it. And then I'll talk about linearized hydrodynamic fluctuations and then non-linearized hydrodynamic fluctuations. And because this is an ADS-CFT workshop, I thought I would say something about ADS-CFT. But most of it is going to be an overview. Like, I really aimed at giving a pedagogical presentation here for people who haven't thought about these things. So I'll start with relativistic hydrodynamics and normal fluids. And so hydrodynamic equations are really contained in the conservation of the energy momentum tensor and possibly other global currents. And of course, the whole point of hydrodynamics is to figure out what exactly this T mu and J mu are. And your first thought when you start thinking about hydrodynamics is, okay, so how hard can it be? Well, so in order to figure out what this T mu and J mu are, well, what you do is you open, a classic textbook, like Landau and Lifshitz, fluid dynamics. And sure enough, Landau and Lifshitz will tell you what this T mu and J mu are going to be. Well, so the stress and energy tensor has this piece, P times the metric plus energy plus pressure times U mu nu. So this is really whatever is called the ideal fluid dynamics, no dissipation. So the same for the current, charge density times the velocity, really, so this means no dissipation. But then there are all these other terms, tau mu that describes dissipation and this little j mu that would describe dissipation. And this tau mu has two pieces. This eta is the shear viscosity, zeta is bulk viscosity. The sigma mu is the shear tensor, some kind of symmetrized version of the derivatives of the fluid velocity. And this little sigma is the charge conductivity, can be related to heat conductivity, if you like. Mu is the chemical potential. This delta is the projector onto the plane orthogonal to U. And you say, okay, so, well, you're done. So this is your fluid dynamics equation. So you go and solve it. But then you try to understand how is it that Landau and Lifshitz presented. And see, the explanation is not very pedagogical. So I think maybe there is another place where you can look up an explanation of your fluid dynamics equations. And well, it's got to be relativistic. So you open another book on relativity, let's say Weinberg's Gravitation and Cosmology. And somehow what Weinberg has looks different from these equations. Because you see, there is this still ideal fluid piece, but then there's this little Q here, which was not there in the Landau-Lifshitz book. And there is no convective, there is no diffusion term for the current. It's just this ideal expression for the current. And moreover, this Q, somehow it has derivative of temperature there was, and the derivative of velocity. But the derivative of the chemical potential that was here, it somehow doesn't appear here. So you look at this and say, huh, these two equations look different. So you get to understand what the difference is. And the lesson that you would learn, so the first lesson is that there is no such thing as the equations of hydrodynamics. As I will explain in a minute or so, so what you mean by the equations of hydrodynamics depends on your choice of how you choose to write them. So this is one comment. And the other comment, which is going to be really the bulk of the talk, is that even if you choose what you choose to mean by your hydrodynamic equations, then hydrodynamics is going to be more than a collection of partial differential equations. So in other words, the way to think about it is as a low energy effective description of a locally thermal system, which is organized as a derivative expansion of auxiliary variables such as your fluid velocity. However, this effective description can be considerably more complicated than a collection of partial differential equations, which are this basically relativistic version of the Navier-Stokes equations that I showed on this slide. So how do you come up with this relativistic versions of the Navier-Stokes equations? So how do you derive these things that, you know, Landau, Lifshitz, and Weinberg have? So the first thing you realize is that, okay, so you're going to describe something that is locally thermalized. So this means that there is going to be a preferred reference frame, which is the rest frame of your fluid. In other words, you're going to describe a relativistic system with broken boost invariants. And therefore, the parameter that describes your system is going to be some kind of preferred time-like vector beta mu. So you know it's got to be one of your variables. And you can choose to write this vector as, you know, some kind of modulus times the direction where this u squared is equal to minus 1. So this u, I mean, don't think about this as fluid velocities. Think about it as just, you know, some time-like, you know, vector that is going to be your hydrodynamic variable. And another thing you realize is that, of course, if you're going to describe a charged fluid, well, you're going to describe a system with broken charge conjugation. So you have to have a field in your description that is transforms that is out under charge conjugation. So it's going to be a scalar field, which I will call mu. And of course, given an arbitrary time-like vector, you can decompose your energy momentum tensor in the current in terms of, you know, basically components which are, you know, orthogonal and longitudinal with respect to this vector. And again, so this has nothing to do with fluid velocity. So this decomposition is an identity. Right? So there's no hydrodynamics here. It's just an identity decomposition. This says, let's say the current has a piece which is along u and also has a piece which is transverse to u. So this is all it's saying.
But u is still a velocity, right?
At this point, u is an arbitrary time-like vector field.
But
it has nothing to do with
the boost that you should apply in order to go to a rest frame, local boost?
It's time-like, so.
Yes, but is it possible to go to a, I mean, you said that boost invariance is broken by a preferred frame.
Yeah.
Then I can go to a frame where I'm at rest, and that's the frame where this u only has a.
That's right. So in this frame.
Sorry, that's what I call a velocity.
That's right. So, however, you will be able to do this only when you are in equilibrium, not when you're out of equilibrium.
But if I'm in local equilibrium, locally I can apply a local boost that's going to make this.
That's right. However, I will come back to this. So what you mean by velocity is actually up to you to choose. Right, so this is so far an arbitrary decomposition, so there is no hydrodynamics here. So the assumption of hydrodynamics comes in saying that these coefficients in this decomposition, you know, big E, P, you know, Q, T, little j, n, so that these coefficients can be expressed as functions of this local beta minus 1, u, mu, and their derivatives. For example, you would have your big E is a function of T, mu, derivative of U, you know, derivative of temperature, du squared, whatnot. So this is the assumption of hydrodynamics. And once you have expressions like that, then you will have a closed system of equations, which are conservation of this T and J expressed in terms of your variables U, T, and mu. Right, so again, so this is not a decomposition into ideal hydro and dissipative hydro, right? This is just an identity. And then you have these expressions for these conditions. All right. So so how do you write these expressions for your T and J in terms of your temperature, chemical potential, and the velocity? Okay. So the way to do it is you organize this expansion in power subderivatives of these hydrodynamic variables. And you start with ideal hydrodynamics, which means ideal or perfect fluid. This means your T and J have no derivatives of your variables, T mu and U. Then you have normal viscous hydrodynamics, which is the relativistic generalization of the Navier-Stokes equations, when you have T and J to first order in derivatives. Then, of course, you can go to second order hydro when you expand this to second order in derivatives. You can go to third order and so on. Right, so you organize these expansions for T and J in as a power in derivatives of your variables. So this is the first step. So the second step is that you use the equations of ideal fluid dynamics to actually reduce the number of possible terms that would be allowed there by Lorentz symmetry. For example, the equations of ideal, that is, zeroth order fluid dynamics will tell you some kind of relation between time derivative of the velocity, but time derivative meaning alone u, derivative of temperature, derivative of the chemical potential. And then you can use these equations to eliminate eliminate your variables at any given order. Let's say if you use them in normal viscous hydrodynamics, then the error you're going to make is going to only enter in second order and so on. Yeah, so this kind of relations are a great help if you work to a given order in the derivative expansion. Does this make sense? And of course, you will have new transport coefficients that will appear at every given order in the derivative expansion. So for uncharged fluids, we have two coefficients at first order, which is the shear and bulk viscosity. At second order, you will have 10 coefficients and you know so on. Now, the question is, how do you count the number of possible transport coefficients in fluid dynamics? And this counting is highly non-trivial. So it's not like you can write down, you know, some kind of terms built out of your, you know, T, mu, and U, which are allowed by Lorentz symmetry or maybe conformal symmetry. And then the number of these independent tensor structures will tell you about the number of your transport coefficients. It's actually more complicated than that, because if you're going to just naively do that, you will overcount. And it turns out that there are other conditions that are needed in fluid dynamics, such as you have to impose the positivity of entropy production. We have to impose the consistent thermodynamic relations of correlation functions in order to actually find the correct number of your transport coefficients. So you're just counting the possible tensor structures that you can write down in the decomposition of T and J is not going to be enough. And so this is something that you would not naively expect, but this is something that's actually true. You can use other things. You can use Onsager relations for transport coefficients to eliminate some of these transport coefficients. So there are several methods to do this.
When you introduce a transport coefficient, do you specify a certain symmetry that this has to satisfy?
No.
So for example, like if I have conductivity, mm-hmm. I could say naively, mm-hmm. that's T odd, but maybe mm-hmm. someone can hook up a T even.
Well, you know that you're going to describe physics that does not respect time reversal invariance. So you just basically write down everything that is both T odd and T even, and then you see what kind of relations you can
so
get.
So just given a vector,
That's right. Now, of course, you can ask questions such as, you know, it depends on the theory that you're studying, right? So if you say you're studying a series broken parity, then you will be able to write down, you know, a great deal more terms in your constitutive relations because parity is no longer a symmetry. You would have, you know, things like Hall viscosity and so on. So this is one procedure this is the first step basically of figuring out what these fluid dynamical equations look like. And the second step is that if you look at this expansion for the energy momentum tensor and the current, this ones, then you will realize that this little j, this little q, little t, they can only be constructed out of the derivatives of your fluid dynamical variables, and therefore they will only be there when you're out of equilibrium. Now, in equilibrium, you will only have these terms, and therefore, in equilibrium, you will be able to give your terms, to give your parameters a physical interpretation. So, in equilibrium, you will be able to define, to identify T as temperature, mu as the chemical potential, and U as the fluid velocity. Now, if you're out of equilibrium, there is no such thing as a fundamental, you know, out of equilibrium definition of, you know, temperature. On the other hand, out of equilibrium, there is such a thing as a fundamental out of equilibrium definition of, say, the energy momentum tensor. Because the energy momentum tensor is a microscopic operator. You can compute its expectation value in any state. So the energy momentum tensor and the current, they're fundamental. They're much more fundamental than, say, temperature or the velocity. And out of equilibrium, you can actually redefine your fields, you know, temperature, chemical potential, and the velocity in such a way that these redefinitions preserve the energy momentum tensor and the current. So these field redefinitions, when you redefine T of X, mu of X, and U of X, in hydrodynamics, people call them a frame, quote unquote, frame. So people choose a frame. And the condition on this choice of frame, this is the definition of the choice of frame, is such that T and J must be invariant under this field redefinitions, because T and J are physical quantities, unlike T of X, mu of X, and U of X. So this T of X, mu of X, and U of X are really, they're just auxiliary variables that are used to parameterize this physical observables T and J. So in particular, you can define your field T of X such that this script epsilon equals to local thermodynamic energy density. So script epsilon is this one. So you can identify this with the energy density, with the local thermodynamic energy density, by choosing a particular out of equilibrium definition of the field T of X. So similarly, you will be able to identify this one with the thermodynamic charge density by choosing a particular out of equilibrium definition of your field mu of X.
Sorry, but in that case, wouldn't then this T of X be the local temperature at each point X or not?
Well, there is no such thing as local temperature. So temperature is only defined in equilibrium.
It's not global, but still, can't you not always in some very small neighborhood define temperature? Even out of equilibrium?
It's up. You can define, but how you define it, it's up to you.
It's not unique.
That's right. It's only unique if you are in equilibrium. That's right.
Out of curiosity, I don't quite understand where you're going to, but
I'm just trying to explain how to get this equation that you find in Landau-Lifshitz. That's where I'm going to.
Why, I know the derivation, but why don't you work directly with the Boltzmann equation from which this hydrodynamic equation is just followed?
Well, Boltzmann equation is kind of, first, it's not a fundamental equation. So it's not.
Neither is.
So writing down Boltzmann equation requires assumptions first it requires that your physical system is made out of particles. So if you're interested in systems such as the Corbillon plasma created in Hewaian collision, so that's not a system that's made out of particles.
Well, there is a way to derive Boltzmann equation directly from Dyson-Schwingel equation, which definitely is applicable in Corbillon plasma.
I don't think so.
The infrared limit of Dyson-Schwinger equation is Boltzmann
equation. Dyson-Schwinger equation for what?
For non-stationary situation which you are considering. You just
so what's your distribution function in the Boltzmann equation?
Exactly, it's how you call it, solution of that equation. It's not given there.
No, no, but what's the microscopic definition?
It's just equation for it's if you're asking what is it in the Dyson-Schwinger equation, you just take the Keldysh propagator, mm-hmm. put the quantity which stands in front of the product of the conjugate exponents, that is just particle distribution, mm-hmm. the one which stands in front of the product of
mm-hmm. exponents non-conjugate to each other is just the average of AA. And this is
ambers. Wait, what's A?
A is a creation number.
Creation operator for what?
It's written for, okay, it doesn't matter. Just quantity standing in front of this.
But no. But when you talk about creation operators, you implicitly talk about particles.
The answers for the Kelmich propagator, which solves the Dirac-Schrödinger equation. The answers looks like that. Exponent times conjugate exponent times some quantity, which you call the distribution number. Exponent times the same kind of exponent. The quantity standing in front of it is just anomalous average. You plug it there, you find the equations for these two quantities, which are called Boltzmann equations. Usually for Boltzmann equation, the second quantity is just zero. But in principle, it could be there.
But you agree this is not the most general, right? It's really expanding around the exponentials.
No, I'm just trying to understand don't take me wrong. I'm just trying to understand why are you studying the...
No. I'm studying...
Rather than studying the situation which is more clear.
I don't think Boltzmann equation is clear at all.
Well, it's more fundamental than the equation which you are deriving.
I agree. It may be more fundamental.
Perhaps we can continue this debate later. Yeah. This is at least one approach. So let's hear this approach, and then perhaps afterwards we can continue.
All right. So maybe okay. So maybe one answer that I can give is. Is if you think about the simplest possible description of many particle systems, so the simplest possible description would be thermodynamics. So this is the simplest effective theory that you can get, thermodynamics. So the next simplest effective theory is fluid dynamics. So the next simplest effective theory would be something that is written maybe in terms of, you know, in terms of distribution functions, such as the Boltzmann equation. So the next one is going to be maybe your...
I'm sorry, I was quoting exactly the last chapter, last volume of Van der Leeuwen's, first two chapters. You were quoting six volumes, I'm quoting the tenth
volume. let's talk about this. Great, so you can choose your local T, local mu, such that this become a local thermodynamic energy density and number density. And then you also have choices of how you choose your U field. And for example, you can choose your U field in such a way that this little j in your decomposition is equal to zero. And this is the choice that was made by Eckert. But you can also choose your U in such a way that this little q is zero. And this was the choice that made by Landau and Lifshitz. Or you can choose U in such a way that some combination of this J and Q is zero. And this will be, you know, your own frame.
But this is a little bit at odds with the way that we were approaching, right? So you first started with this beta. Mm-hmm. Now you're saying I can define U mm-hmm. as the eigenvector of T mu mm-hmm. or the one of the current, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, now you're saying, in a sense, you began saying, well, I begin with beta, this gives me a u. And now you're saying, I can...
You can redefine beta instead of u.
You can redefine beta.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then beta is not what's well-defined. What's well-defined is t mu and j mu.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So the starting point, I think, should have been the t mu and j mu.
Well, it depends how you think about it. So the way I like thinking about it is that this T mu and U are really a field, are really auxiliary fields which can be redefined. So the situation here is kind of analogous to gauge theory. So you have something that's gauge invariant, and then you can choose whatever gauge you want.
So. I agree with everything you say. It's just the order of what's the starting point.
Right. And of course, whatever I was saying here is, I just said how this works in relativistic hydrodynamics. But exactly the same thing happens in non-relativistic hydrodynamics. It's just people usually completely ignore this when they write books in non-relativistic hydro. So if you know any book in non-relativistic hydro that explains this in any detail, please let me know. Because normally in non-relativistic fluid dynamics, you choose a particular definition of U, so, which corresponds to this little j is equal to zero. But you could have chosen other definitions of U. And again, it's up to you to choose. But normally, when people write down, you know, equations of fluid dynamics, non-relativistic fluid dynamics, they write them in one particular form and they say these are the equations of fluid dynamics. But you have to keep in mind that there is some assumptions.
Their point there, it's the question they're trying to answer, right? They're really concerned with.
No. And it's understandable why you do this, because this choice means that your velocity is the velocity of your particle number. So you can actually tag your particles in a fluid and you can measure these things. So it makes total sense. But from like a fundamental theoretical physics point of view, it's, yeah. All right, so this first order equations of Eckert, Landau, Lifshitz that you would find, you know, in Landau, Lifshitz book or say in Weinberg's book, they're related by the choice of frame, plus the use of the ideal hydro equations that would allow you to transform from one set of variables to another set of variables. Like say, this equation would allow you to eliminate, let's say, the derivative of the chemical potential in favor of dT and dU. Now, to solve these equations, you need to know, of course, the pressure as a function of T and mu, that's the equation of state. You need to know in charged fluid three dissipative transport coefficients, shear, bulk viscosity, charge conductivity. Both pressure and the transport coefficients, they're constrained by the stability of the thermal equilibrium state. So the constraints on these ones are very simple. They have to be non-negative. The constraint on pressure, actually the constraint on pressure as a function of T and mu is a bit subtle if you express it as a function of T and mu, but if you express pressure as a function of energy density, you know, at constant entropy, then it's actually pretty easy. The constraint is, you know, dP, d epsilon greater than zero, which means your speed of sound is a real number, not an imaginary number. so that's some constraints on your input. Then the last comment is that complete classification of these second order terms in relativistic hydro, it could have been done in 1950s, but it was only done starting 2007 with a lot of help from the ADS-CFT correspondents. So people could have done this earlier, but they didn't.
So one question. So before you said that there are fewer transport coefficients than possible Lorentz structures.
That's right.
And the reason you said was that there are conditions like stability, positivity
of entropy. That's right.
But in this case, so these eta, xi, and sigma are constrained, but they are still independent. So that in this case, you don't reduce the number of possible Lorentz structures at this order. Right?
No. Even in this order, this happens. So at this order, for example, when you write down all possible Lorentz structures, you would actually find that there are four. There is something else in addition to eta, zeta, and sigma. And that something else you set to zero by the condition of the positivity of entropy production or positivity of, say, by Onzaga relation. I can tell you what that extra guy is. So it's actually pretty easy to say what it is. So if you look at, say, the Landau frame expression for your current, so this is the normal term that gives you the charge diffusion. But when you write down this constitutive relation, so your first guess would be this. You have two scalar fields, which is mu and t, and this is a vector. So you can write a derivative of mu and a derivative of t. So this is what you would do, derivative of mu and the derivative of t. Now, so this would give you two coefficients. But it turns out that, the positivity of entropy production constrains you so that it's not, you know, some coefficient times derivative of mu plus some other one times derivative of t. It's only this combination that appears.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so the next one is fluctuations in linear fluid dynamics. Well, okay, so it's easiest to do this around the static equilibrium. I will only do this in static equilibrium in this talk. It's like a lot of interesting things happen when you're not in static equilibrium. I'm not doing this. So when you linearize your fluid dynamical equation around the static equilibrium, you will find basically two modes. One is the fluctuation of the transverse velocity. Transverse means with respect to your spatial momentum. So it gives you this purely diffusive damping frequency. The other one is the sound wave. It has the real part and the imaginary part. And the damping of this, both the shear mode and the sound mode, is determined by the viscosities. So again, so this Z is the bulk viscosity, it is the shear viscosity. Yeah. So what else is here? So if you look at this one, so what this tells you actually that so the damping here is proportional to k squared. So as a result of this, your low frequency sound waves will propagate much farther than high frequency sound waves. I don't know if, but this is probably related to, I don't know why whales use, you know, low frequency communication rather than high frequency communication. Now, these eigenmodes, these ones, from the quantum field theory point of view, so because this was pure hydrodynamics, but from the quantum field theory point of view, these eigenmodes, they manifest themselves as singularities of two-point correlation functions of your energy momentum tensor. So let's say if you take your special momentum along x, then your transverse momentum in the y direction will have this shear mode singularity, and your longitudinal momentum in the x direction will have this sound mode singularity. So RET means retarded correlation functions in thermal equilibrium. And the way to derive these equations is, you know, these are small fluctuations. You can just use linear response theory. And so it's pretty straightforward to derive them in linear response theory. And you can massage these equations in various forms that would give you Kuba formulas, so-called Kuba formulas, for the shear and bulk viscosity that express your transport coefficients as two-point correlation functions. All right, so now I want to make one comment, which is maybe not very well known about these correlation functions. Now, if you look at charge fluids and look at correlation functions in a state that has finite charge density, you know, finite mu, finite n in equilibrium. Okay, so first thing you know is that correlation functions of T and J, they must be frame invariant. Okay. So if I take, let's say, the Landau-Lifschitz formulation, I take my equations from the Landau-Lifschitz book, and I compute this correlation function, well, this is what I get. So this is what I showed you in the previous slide. There is this, you know, beautiful singularity at omega is equal to minus I gamma k squared. But then you can ask the following question. Well, what if you don't use the Landau-Lifschitz formulation? What if you use the Eckert formulation? I mean, the two are supposed to be equivalent, and they are equivalent. So what happens if you just take the fluid dynamical equation from the Weinberg's book and not from the Landau-Lifschitz book? Well, you compute this correlation function, and it looks different. Now there is this piece here, 1 plus I omega divided by omega naught. This omega naught is related to charge density, conductivity, energy density plus pressure. Now, see the denominator now. So this was a linear function of omega. This is now a quadratic function of omega. So there are two roots, two singularities of this correlation function. And one of them is your normal shear singularity, minus I gamma k squared. And the other one is plus I omega naught, where omega naught is this. Now this one is in the lower complex half plane, as it should be. Now this one is in the upper complex half plane, as it should not be. Right? So whenever you have something in the upper complex half plane, this means you have an instability. This instability was discovered by Hiscock and Lindblom, 1985. And of course, they said, well, OK, there's an instability, so we have to abandon hydrodynamics and come up with some kind of more exotic theories, like Israel-Stewart theories, that would cure this instability. Now, I don't think this is the right approach. This is not the right way to do. This is not the right way to think about it, because if you think about this frequency, this frequency is really a microscopic frequency. So the time scale determined by this frequency is, if you think about the particle picture, it's really the mean free time between particle collisions. So if you think about the frequencies that hydrodynamics is supposed to describe, so it's only supposed to be applicable for frequencies which are much, much, much smaller than this omega naught. So, and the correct way to interpret this correlation function is not to say that there's an instability. This instability is really fake, is to actually expand this denominator in powers of omega and move this into the numerator. And if you do this, then it becomes pretty clear that whatever this effect is really secretly a quote-unquote contamination from second and third order hydrodynamics. So this instability is not really a physical instability. It's really as a contamination by second order, in this case, maybe even third order hydro. And this is something that happens quite often. So when you naively take your hydrodynamic equations, let's say to first order in derivative expansion, so the normal relativistic Navier-Stokes equations, and you compute your correlation functions. It's not that you, it turns out that you cannot necessarily trust every single term in that correlation function, because some of the terms in your correlation functions may be sensitive to, you know, second order and third order hydro. And you have to check that something like that does not happen. So in this case, this is precisely an example of when you become sensitive to higher order hydrodynamics. And you would naively think this is an instability, but it's actually not.
So Pavel, is there no system in which is omega zero becomes low enough, small enough, that you'd be tempted to say that it should be there in the hydrodynamic?
No, well, I mean, not in the way this hydrodynamics is constructed in the first, but because it's constructed, sigma is the first order quantity. So when you have a derivative expansion, you somehow build this expansion as an expansion of, you know, your, well, we'll assume that essentially mean free path is small. And just sigma is will be sensitive to the mean free path. And you can ask, is there an order of limits?
No, you know? What I'm asking is, suppose you have a system which the mean free path is one of the temperature, right? Some is there no example in which omega zero is much smaller than the temperature, for example? So that one of our omega zero is much bigger than one of the t. And so that omega is really in the hydrodynamic.
I don't think so.
But the argument about sigma and the relations of mean free path, that's a very perturbative argument.
It's
asking something about a strong coupling.
No. I understand. So the argument is really the argument of the limit, right? So your hydrodynamics is really supposed to only be valid in the limit omega goes to zero. Now this is a quantity which is order one, right? So normally the hydrodynamic modes, they capture the limit omega goes to zero and k goes to zero. Simultaneously, so omega is or a k squared, whatnot.
So you say this is not dependent then on the particle.
This is not dependent. That's right.
So it's true. Weak coupling strong.
That's right.
Okay. That's something that is caught, and then you should have been able to figure out just based on the magnitude of that term, or is it some more subtle thing?
I think so. I mean, their analysis was completely correct in the sense that, you know, they looked at the equations and they found that the equations have an unstable mode. But I guess they didn't think about this in terms of like effective field theory picture. They didn't think about this as in terms of, you know, what kind of degrees of freedom your field theory is supposed to capture. How to put it? Exactly the same thing would happen, for example, let's say you work with high derivative gravity. Let's say if you add, you know, r squared, you know, terms and so on, to the normal Einstein gravity, then you will find that there are some unphysical modes there. Now, these unphysical modes don't mean that, you know, you have to completely throw away your derivative expansion in gravity. This simply means that the mass of those unphysical modes is roughly speaking at the Planck scale, right? And this simply means, so you don't use your effective theory at the Planck scale. You use your derivative expansion in gravity at extremely low energies where it is supposed to work. So the same thing here. So you have a mode whose frequency is of order one, so it gives you an instability. So the lesson is, well, don't use your effective theory at such frequencies. Use it at much low frequencies where it was only supposed to work.
If it is nonlinear, it might go to those frequencies.
Say it again?
So if you're dealing with the nonlinear level, you might try to start at a region of frequencies where you don't have this problem, but yet then you might run away into that.
Yeah, that's right. But these are the frequencies where hydrodynamics has no place to begin with, and has no place, right? So at those frequencies, you really have to have some other kind of description. So non-hydrodynamic description.
I agree with that. I really agree with what you said, but the thing is that hydrodynamics usually has the tendency to work better than one has any right to expect. Right? And sometimes people will just push farther, and then they find that it still works. Yeah. And when people introduce something to fix this, they say, it works better than we had any right from the point of view of effective field theory.
I mean, from the point of view of effective field theory, there is no need to fix this because this is not a problem.
Yeah, it's not a problem. It's simply that your effective theory, get to the cutoff of this.
That's right, exactly.
But then, and people, in particular, when they are doing numerical calculations, they like to extend them.
That's right. So for the purposes of convenience of numerical calculations, it may be useful to kind of mock around with hydrodynamics.
But Pavel, sorry to do this, but in your example with high derivative gravity, suppose this omega zero turns out to be much, much, much below the Planck scale.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do with it? Would you then say you have to take this pole seriously or not? Because then it's within the regime of applicability of your effective theory.
At what scale would it set it to be less than the Planck scale?
Well, I was saying, so in the hydrodynamic case, if you have a system where the only scale is the temperature, the mean free path is going to be 1 over t.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is that if omega, or whatever omega if you want, is much bigger than 1 over t, this is a wavelength that's supposed to be captured by hydrodynamics because it's way
mm-hmm.
beyond the mean free path. So what would you do? What would you do in that case? Would you take it seriously or would you not?
I think it's. I think.
You're cutting off at a scale much lower than the.
But this is telling you that your cutoff, your naive cutoff, was wrong.
Presumably, there are high derivative terms in the charge or in the cast, and those high derivative terms are controlled by omega naught and not by one.
You have some small dimension expanding there.
Mm.
That's giving you a much smaller cutoff.
So you're saying I misestimated my
your cutoff,
yeah.
Yeah.
My mean free path.
Just a silly question. For this specific instability, is this cured at third order? If you go to the third order in the Navier-Stokes, the equivalent of the Navier-Stokes equations in third order in derivatives, is this instability still there, or it's cured?
I haven't checked it. Yeah, I haven't checked it. Like when I saw this for the first time, for me the only point was to convince myself that this is just an artifact of higher order thing. But I didn't play with sort order higher myself. All right. So I showed you correlation functions in first order hydra. You can do the same thing in second order hydra. So one popular term that shows up quite a bit in second order hydrodynamics is the so-called, initially due to Israel Stewart, but then it was kind of put in modern language by BRSSS. and you can work out correlation functions, of course, with these terms too. I mean, really, it's quite straightforward. You know, I just wrote a mathematical program, you know, and you just give it the constitutive relation, spits out at you, you know, the correlation function, which is beautiful. And let's say if you look at the correlation function of transverse stress, then you see this beautiful derivative expansion. You know, this P is a contact term. You can argue it comes from your ideal hydro. Then there is this omega eta from the normal Navier-Stokes equation. Then there is this quadratic term that comes from second order hydro, and so on. Okay, so this is a first order transport coefficient, second order transport coefficient, and so on. So far, so good. Now, I want to move on to the nonlinear hydro fluctuation and ask the question, what happens there? Now, I'm only going to talk about very weak nonlinearities in hydrodynamics. And taking into account small nonlinearities in hydrodynamics is like taking into account small interactions in field theory. So what happens when you take into account weak nonlinearities in hydrodynamics, then interactions of these, you know, shear waves and sound waves, they will give rise to connected, you can think about them as three level, 3 point, 4 point, and so on, correlation functions of the hydrodynamic variables. And people started to look at them, you know, a couple of years ago, mostly because some of the second order transport coefficients had Kubo formulas for them that were given by 3 point correlation functions, not 2 point correlation functions. But then there is another thing, is that, you know, from what happens in quantum field theory is that when you introduce a little bit of interaction, you not only get yourself, you know, connected, you know, three-level, three-point functions, but you will also get corrections, loop corrections, to two-point functions of T mu and J mu. And these corrections, they will renormalize your naive, quote-unquote, bare values of your viscosity, conductivity, and so on. Now, this loop corrections that I'm talking about, they are loops of your effective theory, so loops of your shear and sound waves. They're not loops of your fundamental quantum fields. So we'll talk about these loops a little bit here. So to see where this comes about, I'd like to talk about the shear viscosity. So shear viscosity, normally it would be proportional to the mean free path, as Maxwell pointed out a long time ago. So if you have a flow of fluid, there's these arrows that represent the flow of fluid, the velocity increases from top to bottom, and these blue arrows are the particles that jump between layers of fluid, that transfer momentum between different layers of fluid, and as a result, this inhomogeneous velocity profile will equilibrate. And your viscosity is going to be proportional to the mean free path, you know, 1 over sigma is the cross section on the conductivity, basically inversely proportional to your to the coupling constant in a weakly coupled fluid. Now, if you think about collective excitations, then you can think about the following. So momentum between your different layers of fluid can not only be transferred by fundamental excitations, but also by collective excitations. So you can actually have exactly the same picture where you can have sound waves which move between different layers of fluid and transfer momentum. And you can ask, where do these sound waves come from? Well, they come from because they're in the fluid already because you have a finite temperature system. And so the mean free path of these sound waves is now inversely proportional to k squared. And when you look at the correction to viscosity that comes from this kind of contribution, the one that comes from collective excitations, well, it's inversely proportional to the viscosity itself. So it's got some cutoff, some UV cutoff, which is the cutoff of your effective field theory. And of course, if you look at this, then in two spatial dimensions, you'll see something funny will happen. You'll get IR divergence. So the lesson is that this kind of fluctuations, they may do interesting things to your transport coefficients. And this physics is invisible if you view hydrodynamics as merely a set of classical partial differential equations. So this is really looking at fluctuations which are beyond. So this is like, if you wish, taking into account quantum fluctuations in quantum field theory, and not just looking at your field theory as a classical theory.
In this case, we should really think of this correction as coming from quantum fluctuations.
No. This is actually a classical fluctuation. This is thermal fluctuations. So this kind of physics would be there in a purely classical theory, like a gas or billiard balls, which is actually exactly where this effects were observed in the first place, in numerical simulations of gases of billiard balls. So it's a thermal effect. It's not a quantum effect. So I was thinking of trying to give a quantitative explanation of these effects, but it would take too much time. So I just give you a cartoonish calculation of how this works. So let's say you choose a Landau frame, and you look at your current. So your current has convective term, it has a diffusive term. For small fluctuations around your, let's say, charge neutral state, your current looks like, again, it has a convective term, it has a diffusive term, okay, normal thing. And the interactions, they come, of course, from the non-linearities of the hydrodynamics. So this one will couple your, you know, diffusive mode and, let's say, the sound mode. And when you look at the correlation function of two currents, so you will have correlation function of the diffusive mode times the sound mode. So this one is the diffusion, e to the minus d k squared t. This one is the sound or the shear mode, you know, e to the minus gamma k squared t. You do this integral in d spatial dimensions, and you get, you know, 1 over d plus gamma. So gamma is just viscosity over energy density plus pressure, t to the power of d over t. Now, so this is something, again, that was observed first in numerical simulations in the 1960s. The mathematical theory for it also appeared around the same time. So this is known as the so-called mode-mode coupling theory in many body physics.
Isn't that just saying that the J satisfies the diffusion equation? Or, sorry, N satisfies the diffusion equation. Okay, D is dressed like gamma. But if I just look at the solution of the diffusion equation, it's going to go always in any D dimensions as T to the...
No. This is different. So this is a correlation. No, this is a correlation function at zero spatial momentum.
But the momentum is going to go into the
problem. You're thinking about position space.
Yes.
This is correlation function. This is in momentum space at zero momentum.
I see. Okay.
Right. So if you were in momentum space, then the contribution from the diffusion equation in momentum space. So this is what this would look like.
Yes. But this is a Fourier transform of that.
So That's right.
But I don't find it so surprising.
No. This one is not surprising. So what I'm saying that this is not a consequence of just that. This is a consequence of that and the fact that you have non-linearities in hydrodynamics. Because the diffusion equation is a linear equation. And by the way, all right. So if you Fourier transform and you see what this implies for your retarded correlation functions, then in three spatial dimensions you get current correlation functions goes as omega to the 3/2. This one goes as omega log omega. If you use the Kubo formula for your charge conductivity, well, the Kubo formula is normally would be given by the zero frequency limit of this divided by omega. So in three spatial dimensions, your full conductivity is what you thought was your conductivity plus the square root. In two spatial dimensions, your conductivity is what you thought was your conductivity plus a log. I take omega goes to zero in the log. Well, that's something bad. also, something needs to be done about that. Exactly the same thing applies to the shear viscosity. There's a log contribution in two spatial dimensions, square root contribution in three spatial dimensions. So I will talk about these cases one by one. So first I talk about two spatial dimensions, and then I talk about three spatial dimensions.
Is there any dependence on the temperature?
That's right. So the these coefficients will depend on the temperature. And these coefficients actually will be 1 over the viscosity itself.
Yeah. That's right.
Mention two spatial dimensions first. So in two spatial dimensions, so you have this logarithmic contributions. Well, it's actually log of omega divided by your cutoff. And what you can do exactly the same thing as you do in normal perturbative quantum field theory when you encounter logarithmic divergences. You define your one loop running conductivity as your conductivity at a scale lambda. Well, lambda is your frequency scale, omega is equal to lambda. Do the same for viscosity. Right? And then you demand that your physical observables, which is your correlation functions, they do not depend on lambda, which is your artificial scale. And this gives you RG equations for your shear viscosity and the conductivity. And so these RG equations, so they look a little bit different from the ones that you would normally see in perturbative quantum fields.
What do these RG equations do? They sum up loops?
They would sum this particular one loop diagrams this way.
You mean this Lenin log that all loops? But that's what RG equation do.
That's right. So in this particular case, in order to talk about this, this statement, you would actually need to have the full framework of systematic analysis of these fluctuations, which I don't have yet. I mean, I have like a little bit of an argument, but like I don't have.
Just a guess.
That's right. So they look a little bit different. And so you can rewrite them as RG equations for dimensionless coupling constants. So this one is viscosity over entropy, and this one is conductivity over charge susceptibility. This is a dimensionless order one coupling constant. And the C is a parameter that counts the number of degrees of freedom in your theory. It's basically, so this is in a CFT. So this is entropy divided by temperature squared. Right? And so this C is going to be a large number in a large N theory. So the right-hand side of these RG equations will disappear in the large N limit. So this loop effects and the running of your viscosity and the conductivity is going to disappear in the large N limit.
Where did you get this equation? It's like you wrote them schematically.
Yeah.
Exactly, you can see the coefficients, right?
This comes when you actually know what these constants are. Okay. So, and you have to actually do the honest calculation to find what these constants are. So, this way. So these are beautiful equations. You can ask about the flow of your transport coefficients in two special dimensions. So this is what the flow diagram looks like. So this is your viscosity over entropy density. This is your conductivity divided by charge susceptibility. And what you see is, so this arrows, they point towards the infrared, low frequency. And in the extreme infrared, all these lines would asymptote to this dashed line with a unit slope, which means that in the infrared, you will get viscosity over entropy is equal to basically charge conductivity divided by the susceptibility. So what this tells you this lesson that eta and sigma, they're not independent transport coefficients in the infrared. So you thought they were when you first throw down your constitutive relations. But if you take this seriously, this tells you that that they are not.
So you don't have any particle number, you don't get any constraint. You don't have any particle number if you have a neutral fluid.
Yeah.
You don't get, it's not that I can take.
Well, no. If you have a neutral fluid, then you simply don't have sigma. But you still have the same equation for the viscosity, and so this would tell you that your viscosity will grow in the infrared as something like square root of the log of the scale. Something like that.
So Pablo, the outcome of this you're saying is that I write down this hydrodynamic theory, mm-hmm. where I think that these two coefficients are independent.
That's right.
But then that effective theory itself tells me that they are not in the far infrared. There's no other assumption that went into.
That's right. That's your right.
It's just hydrodynamics.
That's right. That's right. You do not input the relation between these coefficients. That's right.
Which makes it natural to ask how that relation holds in ABS form.
Yeah. But see.
No. That relation depends in the large and limit disappears, but on the next one,
mm-hmm.
that one is independent of. Right. The
data
of S should be equal to sigma t over
chi. But in order to get this, I mean, this follows from this diagram. This diagram is only exists when n is finite.
Yeah.
Right. So, but once they derive, so it's only when n equals finite, and but it's valid for any n, right? So I guess I'm taking a finite n, and now I'm going to make an n goes to infinity limit, asking whether it's
But you cannot do that. I mean, these two limits do not.
I guess the point is that how deep in the infrared you have to go for this relationship to be approximately valid. This infrared scale goes to zero when n goes to infinity, right?
Oh, that's right. So it's I think it's exponential. It's e to the minus like n to some power.
But still, you can compute this in ETS.
If you.
No.
You can. I don't think this will hold. I forgot. One can easily figure out.
It must be your paper.
It must be, yes. It's in some way my paper.
There's no way that these effects are going to show up in a gravitational calculation.
I don't think so.
No, I agree, but
even without knowing that gravity is large n, when you do the calculation and obtaining the viscosity coefficients in a gravitational setup, you don't even need to know that it's large n, whatever. You just do the calculation, you get something, and then those effects are never going to show up.
I understand that effect does not, but here there is a framework where we think about this transport coefficient in terms of the RG running, and so we can ask whether this idea of RG running extends in a gravitational. Up to
but you would need gravitational, you would need quantum gravitational calculation to do
it. So I'm saying that, but again, you in this way you chose observables in a smart way where mm-hmm. quantum effects,
but just one loop, right?
That's right.
One loop, I should be able to
say. That's right. And I mean, I was going to mention this later, but. From what I know, there's only one paper that looked at this, and this was by Simon Cronhout and Amit Saremi in 2009, and from what I could see, they kind of knew the answer, and they were able to bring the loop calculation in the bulk to the form that kind of looks like the right answer, but I don't think this was a completely like start from scratch loop calculation in the ball.
So you have this correction when you compute basically some more loop on top of
that's right.
Sort of leading hydrodynamic result. But in principle, you can say, is there a way how I can translate the square root of omega or log omega into asking the question, what's the structure of if you wish resum chi derivative terms?
I think this is really the wrong way to think about this, because it's like if you take any quantum field theory,
right.
you would try to fit all the quantum effects into some kind of classical theory.
In a classical effective field theory, I guess in this case maybe if you would say that those because of non-analyticity maybe those corrections are non-local so.
No, they're absolutely non-local because they're...
But then, in some sense, the resum thing might also, if it is like a square root of a derivative or something.
I don't want to do this. And the reason I don't want to do this is because this kind of procedure is kind of something that people would do, let's say, in the early 20th century. When people look at the electron and say, the electron has infinite self-energy, electromagnetic self-energy. Therefore, let's cure this infinity by like representing, your electron as a, finite-sized ball.
Change classical.
Yeah, you change the classical theory. But really, this is not.
The classical theory, my effective classical theory that describes all your.
No, but in quantum theory, quantum effective action, which resums for you in a classical.
No, but
that's exactly the. That's what I have in mind. Once you compute the partition function, you write it as effective action.
Once you have the correlation function, just integrate the correlation function with respect to the source. That's going to be your action.
Do you have strong opinion why you don't like to synchronize this one?
And the reason I don't like this is like when you do it in quantum field theory, you start with a fundamental quantum field theory and see what the consequences are. You don't just try from scratch, hook up the classical theory.
But that's not a good argument because in quantum field theory, I would do precisely this. I would write an effective field theory. It would have, infinitely many.
But you would get it from a quantum calculation, right?
Yeah. So in this case, you did a quantum calculations, which in your way are thermal calculations.
And
then I phrase it back as a classical calculation and declare that this is my improved hydrodynamics.
No, the effective action that you have are like just generating function for correlation function,
right?
It's not like you will then solve classical equation.
So if you could do this for gravity or pions, and you would do like every time you do a RG reservation, you change the original classical theory. You don't do this with gravity or pion dynamics. Why would you do this with hydrodynamics?
No, but in quantum field theory, if for example, like I'm interested in the vacuum state, I can write down a quantum effective potential, which by extremizing that, it's a classical expression. If I extremize it,
that's a different thing. I think from what.
Why is it different? I don't understand why is it different. He gets a different, he gets this dispersion relation, which sort of kind of analogous dispersion relation as you would do when you compute loops. And all I'm saying is. Asking the question, what is a classical effective action that produces me this spectrum?
This is an IR effect, isn't it?
Sorry?
This is an IR effect.
Yeah, in an effective field theory, it's also IR.
No. To get an action that would produce this two-point correlation function, it's very easy. Just integrate the correlation function with the source. But
okay.
Is there some reason why they're not independent? I mean, now when you look at retrospect. Is this because there's some relation between the correlation functions in the infrared from the Kubon, the way you would be computing the sigma and eta from the Kubon?
Can you say this again?
Well, if they're not independent transfer coefficients, I can also think of them as coming from the Kubon from the point of view of the correlators, right?
That's right.
The fluctuation
No, it doesn't follow from any kind of word identities.
No, but what I'm saying, so it doesn't follow if you look at the word identities in the infrared, why they would be related.
Yeah, I don't see why, no.
Because, if they're not independent, there has to be a reason for that.
This is like when in quantum theory you float to a given fixed point.
Yeah.
And you relate the
coefficients. It's dynamics that takes you there, and the fact that some coefficients are related at the fixed point is a statement about the dynamics of the theory. You know? I don't think it has anything to do with symmetries, right?
But it's non-perturbative information, which would be in the word identities and things like that.
No, the word identities are related to symmetries. And this is the dynamics. No?
Isn't it? I mean, I think that what he's saying is that it should come from the symmetries of the fixed point.
Yeah, because the fixed point has some.
It's strictly speaking not well defined. Right? Each of these quantity at the fixed point are infinitely normalized.
Well, they're not infinitely normalized, but they surely become large at the fixed point.
Well, maybe, I mean, you can redefine the calculus of the coefficients in such a way that at least one of them is finite.
No. I mean, the largeness comes because the largeness as a function of scale.
Yeah.
How much time do I have?
Minus.
yeah, basically try to go grab up a little bit, so we're not eating too much into coffee time. Another 10 minutes or so.
Oh no, 10 is plenty. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. All right, so I want to see now, this was 2+1 dimensions. Now I want to move to 3+1 dimensions. And in 3+1 dimensions, so remember I showed you this expression for the correlation function of transverse stress in second order hydro. So it's got this thing, you can think about this as ideal hydro, first order hydro, second order hydro. Now, if you take into account this one loop corrections, well, you get something like that, but then you have this omega to the 3 halves. Now, in the hydrodynamic limit, this is less important than this, but this is more important than this. Right? So this tells you that fluctuation effects due to first-order hydro that dominate over second-order hydro. Right? So correlation functions computed in second-order hydro, at least some of the correlation functions, maybe not all of them, they should not be trusted if you ignore thermal fluctuations.
Again, there is 1 over n in there.
That's right. So this is an order of limits. So what this tells you is that the large n limit does not necessarily compute with the hydrodynamic limit. That's right. I mean, it does in 3 dimensions, but not in 2. Now, actually, if this looks a little bit unfamiliar, then I have this one slide that shows that actually the same thing happens with the derivative expansion in gravity. It's not specific to hydrodynamics. So if you think about the hydrodynamics, so expand the energy momentum tensor. Ideal fluids, first order viscous fluids, second order hydro, so on. And then you get corrections to a correlation function. Order 1, order omega comes from here. Order omega squared comes from here. And then you get order omega to 3 halves, which basically comes from one loop effect due to this term. Now, if you think about, let's say, gravity. So in gravity, you can, let's say, in 4 dimensions, you can look at the effective action for gravity. You know, this is normal Einstein gravity, R squared, you know, R mu. And then you can ask the question, what is the gravitational potential between the two masses coming from this action? Well, okay, so this is a normal Newtonian potential. Then there is going to be a GR correction to the Newtonian potential goes as 1 over R. Comes from here. Now, this ones actually will give you exponentially decaying potential, or this masses are this masses of this extra fields that come about from massive fields that come about from this R squared terms. But now if you look at the quantum correction from this term, it actually goes as 1 over R squared. Right. So what you have is you have a quantum correction that goes as 1 over R squared due to this term. And then you have a classical contribution to a gravitational potential. It's coming from this term, which is exponential. Now, sure enough, this is more important than this at long distances. Of course, this also has a h bar in it, right, which is small. So again,
this is the calculation that you should do in the gravitational dual for the fluid, right? And you should compute the 2-point correlation function at the specific tensor, including one effects, and then extract the analytic part in the momenta.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to lead you to the correlation.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't choose to write this in momentum space. I probably could have written in momentum space.
Well, in momentum space, you see more easily what's analytic and what's non-analytic.
That's right.
Part is the one that is cutoff independent.
Yeah, so again, gravitational potentials, it's exactly the same lesson in the derivative expansion in gravity as you have in the derivative expansion in fluid dynamics. So gravitational potential computed in hard derivative gravity should not be trusted if you ignore quantum effects.
Which one is larger? Doesn't that depend on what M0 is?
On what?
What M0 is?
It does. Well, yeah, I mean, M0 is actually the Planck mass. Of the order of Planck mass, but it has also this coefficient here. What I'm saying is that at any fixed M0 at large distances, of course, this is going to dominate, right? Just like you have in this example. So at any finite n at small omega, this is going to dominate over this one. Yeah, it's like what you take to zero first. Do you take h bar to zero first, or do you take r to infinity first?
But you're in in order to make that statement about which one dominates at large r, you're making an implicit assumption of what m naught is relative to h bar. And so if you're saying that m naught is like the Planck mass, for example, or comparable to g h bar, then
well, yeah, I mean numerically it depends on this coefficient on
right.
this coefficient that sit here
right.
as well.
Right.
All right, so. ADS-CFT, I don't have much to say about ADS-CFT. I mean, this whole workshop is about ADS-CFT. So linear fluctuations, it's pretty much well known. Nonlinear fluctuations, it's not, okay. So about nonlinear fluctuations, again, this is something that is very well known, that if you don't look at correlation functions, if you choose to look at the actual fluid dynamical equations, then there's a method which is now known as fluid gravity correspondence that allows you to get the full nonlinear hydrodynamic equations out of Einstein equations in asymptotically ADS space. Now, if you look at weak hydro nonlinearities, then 3 and 4 point functions, they haven't been studied that much. It's only, I think, starting 2010, around 2010, people started to look at this in more detail in fluid dynamics. Mainly because some of the second order transport coefficients were had Kubo formulas that involved 3 point and 4 point functions. Not sure about 4. 3 point functions rather than 2 point functions. And for the 2 point functions, this fluctuation corrections, well, they're one order and suppressed. So this transport coefficients, they come out finite and 3 plus 1 dimensional classical gravity, that you don't see any of this Arjuranian in classical gravity. This Arjuranian only comes from quantum corrections to classical gravity. And as I mentioned, there is this one paper, I think, that looks at it in any detail a couple of years ago.
If I do this quantum calculation in gravity,
yeah.
In principle, I'm doing a calculation which is valid both for finite temperature and zero temperature. You claim that these are thermal fluctuations, so the piece that I'm interested in should be the one that survived. No.
Should be the one?
In the presence of a black hole.
Yeah, so that I agree that changes the calculation. I agree, yeah. But somehow I could also do a calculation at zero temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow the piece
you're
interested in.
Zero temperature, but in the presence of a black hole. Didn't
introduce
thermal.
No, but what if I do it in the absence of a black hole? Like
well, 2 point functions are kind of fixed at zero temperature, right, by conformal symmetry. So you
okay.
So you I mean
so what I want is the difference somehow between the finite temperature and the zero temperature.
Well, the physics that goes into this is really the physics of hydrodynamic moons, right? And you really need the black hole for that. I haven't looked at the guts of this paper, but if I were to start, this is probably where
but
I would.
But then on the gravity side, what's running in the loops are these Poisson normal modes, right?
The hydrodynamic modes, which is one of the Poisson
normal,
which is one of the Poisson normal modes.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
It's within the one that the dominant of these.
But this, I mean, this has been done. I mean, not for this particular in number of places. People have computed it. to find out if x
is what's wrong or not.
Yeah, we also have a paper on a different context.
But specifically, when you look at.
No, you don't need the back reaction. You need the black hole background. You go to Euclidean, Euclidean version, and then the polynomial modes.
In this case, it is a back reaction. So once you compute this one with determinant, then you have to recompute your, you know, diffusing when you take into account the back reaction of this loop determinant.
But you compute it just from the, I mean, it's an extra source term that you have, so you can read from the linear operator.
Yeah, I think I disagree with you, but maybe we should let you.
Yeah, well, I'm basically done. So, I mean, what I would like to understand is actually most of what I said in the last hour. So I only showed one loop corrections. Like, I didn't do higher loops. And pretty much, if you want to do higher loops, you need a systematic treatment of how to deal with these hydrodynamic fluctuations in full relativistic hydro. Now, if you do this in non-relativistic hydro, it's pretty straightforward how to do this. You would do this along the lines of the Landau-Lifshitz fluctuating hydrodynamics when you convert your fluid dynamical equations into stochastic differential equations. And then there is this MSR procedure for evaluating correlation functions in that stochastic field theory. Now, for the relativistic hydrodynamics, it's more tricky. This is something that I'm thinking about, but I don't have the complete picture yet. But something that I wanted to emphasize in this talk is that if you look at the complete effective description of fluids, so it must involve both the derivative expansion and the fluctuations. So for some questions, the high derivative terms will be more important. For some questions, the fluctuation corrections will be more important. If you want a complete description, then both. Have to be there. That's all. Thank you.